Actually, it did produce a very nice colorimetry in terms of, as long as you had the right white phosphor behind it. Various different shades of white, from bluish white to grayish white. There's a whole range of phosphors that they use, and what they used with that was it was almost like a projection tube. Because it was sequential and non-compatible, and because Mr. Sarnoff was who he was and had the power that he had, eventually the government chose the RCA system because it was compatible. But the CBS color wheel system didn't actually die. It sort of transmuted into French SICAM, which is a sequential method of transmission, and it actually works quite well. And that's another thing that has become a thing of the past. Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah. Nowadays, with modern-day storage devices, taking a compatible picture, breaking it up into the red, green, and blue, and then sequentially sending that to cathode ray tubes is a fairly simple thing to do today. In those days, I guess the transmission back at the studio had to be sequential red, green, and blue, otherwise to make the CBS wheel work well. And that represented a real problem because old sets would not be compatible with it. That's what I think you're saying. And so when you chose the right phosphor, with the right persistence of phosphor and the right bluishness of the whiteness of the phosphor, my guess is that color wheel could give you a very clean color. Wonder if you've ever seen one of those in operation, Eric. And when you watch it long enough, does your flicker response sort of disappear?
Pal, I hate going to Europe and I see the fluorescent light flicker. I mean, you got to consider that those field rates were really short, long rather, and it was a long, intensive flicker. But because you're constantly flipping from red, green, and blue, your brain kind of puts it all back together. I was at the NHK Museum in Tokyo not too long ago, and lo and behold, they had a color wheel camera and a color wheel display, and they were working together. And it looks quite amazing for stuff that was built in the late 50s.
So, even though David Sarnoff did it by eminent domain, so to speak, in the big picture, do you think the decision that was made for the NTSC system, as opposed to the CBS system, the so-called RCA system, do you believe in the big picture the right decision was made?
In the long run, based upon technology as it was available, yes. CBS technology used to manufacture black and white TV sets, and if you ever had one, you'd have found an optical socket on the back for the color wheel. The color wheel is this big, ugly box that you put in front of the TV box, and it's just not, I mean, it worked, it was functional, it's just not, you know, beautiful in terms of cabinetry and stuff, and the reality is it's huge, taking up a lot of space, so how practical is that?
Was that noisy in operation, that wheel turning? Did you hear the wind going by inside of its chamber?
Well, the one that I saw in Japan was kind of noisy. You know, it's like anything else. You got a fan motor going, you get used to it.
I understand. Eugene, do you have a quick comment on any of this before we go back to Mel, W2EWK, K2RIW, in the tech tent?
Okay, Dick. Not quite, but I guess I would like to tell you a little slight problem. It'll only take about a second. One quick second. Can I tell you now?
Okay, if it's going to be a minute's worth, go ahead.
Okay, I'm using a beam antenna. You know, to me a beam. And my friend is 2 miles away. I'm on 146.715, okay? 146.715 repeater. And he's on 145.550, okay? I'm using the ICOM 7000. Now, I've got two of these radios, two of them. One's an old one, and one's a brand new one out of the box. He claims that he hears me on 145.550. Now, could that be a harmonica going through his radio?
out of curiosity, does when he tunes that radio to 146.715, does he hear you again?
No, Vic. I'm on 146.715 on the repeater. When he's on 145.550 simplex, he hears me. Is this his problem or my problem?
Not clear. He hears you on 145.55, which is not 600 KC lower than 146.715, which of course is crazy. If he also tuned his radio to 146.715, would he hear you again while you're going through that repeater?
Yes, he'll hear me. If he comes back to me on 146.715, but he claims that I'm giving him a harmonic on 145.5.
Yeah, that could be a so-called M by N product, because you guys are only 2 miles apart. What M by N product means that if you take the second, third, or fourth harmonic of the local oscillator of his receiver, and you take the fact that you're giving him a super strong signal to his RF amplifier, so his RF amplifier is making second, third, and fourth harmonic of the RF frequency it hears, and you mix together the, I'll pick some numbers out of the air here, you pick the third harmonic of the LO and the second harmonic of the RF, and if it turns out to be the first IF frequency, 10.7, you'll get a response. Every radio, when you make the signal super strong, will create another response, M by M response. The way you confirm that is to put a step attenuator in front of the radio that you're suspicious of. And if it is an M by N response, if for instance it's the second harmonic of the RF, and you plug in 10 dB, the signal strength on your signal strength meter will not go down by 10, it'll go down by 20. And if it's the third harmonic, you plug in 10 dB, it'll go down by 30. So that's the easiest way of confirming. The second easiest way is to actually do some tuning. When you're using the second or third harmonic of the LO, and you move the receiver 5 KC, you'll get a response as if you moved it 15 KC. So, by way of looking at the frequency rate of change, or the amplitude rate of change, you can soon confirm. But where you're so close and giving him a very strong signal, most likely it is overload of his receiver creating that response. It doesn't necessarily represent a problem of your rig. Back to you, Eugene.
Okay, thank you very much there, Dick. Now I know what to tell him. Okay, because I don't get that problem over here. Okay, that's it. My final message is over. Thank you very much, Dick. If I need you again, I'll put another dime, a nickel inside the machine. Okay, W2EWK clear.
Yeah, but the machine now runs on quarters. I'm kidding you. Mel, you better grab your chance while you've got it. K2KEY, K2RIW on the tech net.
Okay, this is K2KEY. All right, at least we're all having a good time here. A lot of different aspects of amateur radio and whatever. So it's always great to hear, you know, all sides. And yes, I would expect Eugene, he most likely is getting some images with his friend because of most of your signals pounding in there. And I guess, which is commonplace, you get on HF radio, people tell you you're splattering all over the place. But of course, you could be pounding in on them, and that's just the way the receiver acts until you cut back the RF gain and you see what happens. It eliminates the problem. Let's see, was I going to make any other comments? Oh, yeah, one more comment I was going to make. I believe that the first broadcast that they made from the moon with the color camera they used, I think it had a little miniature color wheel in it, Dick, over.
I'm not sure. I do know that it was RCA. It was K3IUV. K3IUV, Bert Saltoff, is the name of the man working for the RCA laboratories at the time, who built the camera that went on Apollo 12. I believe Apollo 12 was the first camera that had color capability.
and Bert's people, K3IUV, worked on that particular camera. And whether or not it had a color wheel inside would be a very interesting question. But Bert K3IUV for a lot of years was the net control for the PACRATS, the Mount Airy VHF Society in the Philadelphia area. And every Monday night they would have a get-together, and they would start off on 6 meters, then go to 2 meters, and then 220 and 432. Well, they got to 432 at 9 o'clock at night, and I was a big 432 enthusiast, so for me, here on Long Island, I would sign into the 432 net. Every half hour, they switched frequencies, and I would sign into the 432 net at 9 o'clock, and K3IUV Bert was quite often the net control for about a decade. I hope he hasn't retired, and interesting guy to talk to. So he'd be the man to check on that particular camera, Mel. Back to you, Mel.
Dick?
Yeah, go ahead. Maybe Eric's got knowledge about it. Go ahead, Eric.
There's actually an interesting story about the ones that we used on the moon were actually built by Westinghouse, and yes, they had a color wheel in them. Okay, they didn't produce a NTSC picture, and the reason it was brought up recently is that they actually lost the original data in one of the archive places. They seem to have thrown it out. It was a sequential camera. It had a color wheel, a single Vidicon, actually. It produced a non-NTSC signal, and down on Earth, when we were watching it on television, had to go through this large standards conversion process. I think I have here somewhere in my computer, because I was looking at it not too long ago. Yeah, it had a band pass of resolution of 360 lines. It had a limiting factor of 350 lines vertical. The transmitter in the command module was slightly less than 2 megahertz, so it only produced 200 horizontal lines when it was transmitted. What else? Let's see. It was actually similar to the 405 line system that the British used, and it was scan sequential, so, you know, it was red, green, and blue. Go ahead, Dick.
And this is the camera that was on the lunar rover car. I wonder, was there also a camera on the lunar module itself? And you said it was built by Westinghouse. Now, is it Westinghouse that was a subcontractor that supplied critical components? But I thought it was RCA who was the prime contractor for the camera that went on the lunar rover car. I know that the first pictures we saw from Apollo 11, which were monochrome, black and white, kind of fuzzy, a whole lot of persistence, kind of a mediocre quality picture. And then from Apollo 12 or 14 on, they had this much better camera, which I thought RCA was the prime contractor on that camera. Thank you, Eric.
Yeah, I pulled up one of my lights here. I have it. It reads, let me see real quickly. During the Apollo 10 flight, a compact SEC color television camera was used to communicate to Earth, providing real-time color scenes of the Earth, Moon, spacecraft maneuvers, and interior scenes. The performance of this camera under abnormal and adverse conditions was excellent, as may be attested by the millions of viewers of this color television camera first from space. This camera was designed and developed for the NASA Manned Spacecraft Center by Westinghouse Aerospace Division in Baltimore, Maryland. The camera is unique in concept, blah, 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 blah. A ground station color converter later changes the sequential color signal to standard NTSC. The approach is new in that a simple and reliable method is used in the camera where the most important relegates to complexity of generating a compatible broadcast signal to the ground where it is readily handled. And it goes on and on and on.
Okay, that's the camera that was used on Apollo 10 from the Apollo spacecraft itself. Does that also represent the exact same camera they put on the lunar rover car?
I believe it is. I believe that's what they used for the entire series. They made newer versions of it that were smaller and lighter.
Okay, next time I get a chance to
talk to Bert. I'm going to ask him about this. Fascinating subject. K2KEY, you got it, Mel. K2IW in the tech net.
Roger, this is K2KEY. I remember reading about it because there was no compact color cameras at the time available. And also I was fooling around a lot with flow scan at the time at its infancy. And eventually I did build a scan converter so that I didn't have to look at it anymore in that P7 phosphor. And the scan converter tubes were becoming somewhat popular for a while there, because they were using a number of these tubes in the space, as Eric said, you know, to change over to NTFC from the sequential system that they were using. So there's a company went into business of making these tubes that you could write in at one particular speed and read out at another speed, that's like NTFC speed. So anyhow, that was interesting to experiment with them, Dick, with the scan converters. Yeah, like I say, came a long way now. Now you just put a plug in a computer program and you can go on flow scan very easily. As I got back to emails, one of the emails asked an interesting question I thought would be a good demonstration of the Smith chart for tonight. And the person mentioned that he does not have a handheld antenna analyzer, nor a any of the noise generators or anything like that. And he described his antenna system to me. And he asked what we can tell him about it. And I basically said, you listen, we can tell you quite a bit about it. So a brief description of his antenna. He has a quarter wave vertical on 20 meters with 16 radials. And it's connected to, the vertical is connected with 100 feet of RG8U coax to an SWR bridge and then to the rig. So if everybody wants to get their Smith chart ready, so we can do a little bit of demonstration of how you can determine a lot about the antenna, even with the simplest of testing device. So I'll give a break for a minute, everybody, to get ready with their Smith chart. You need your compass and your straight edge. Let me let it go for a second, see if there's anybody who wants to make any comments before we go ahead. Okay, well, okay, now you got your Smith chart. He does say that at 14.000, the vertical exhibits the best SWR of 1.7, and that's the low end of the 20-meter band, also the CW portion of the band. So with this, let's plot first the 1.7, and taking your compass, put the pin of the compass on the center of the chart at 1.0, open the compass up to 1.7, that's on towards the right of 1.0, go down the line there, open the compass up to that point, and we're going to make a complete 360-degree circle. Now let's look at old back theory, you know, on verticals. Basically, a quarter-wave vertical, we also know that the definition of resonance is that the antenna actually would produce, most likely present actually a somewhat of a, what we call purely resistive load to the line. Basically, that means no reactive component. So keeping that in mind, if we look at the circle that we just drew, there seems to be two spots on the circle. Remember, somewhere on the circle represents the impedance of his antenna system. Now, there's two places on the circle that give us this theoretical point of plus J0, as we said that the vertical should be somewhere around, 36 ohms possibly. Yeah, usually that's what the book usually tell you, it's 36 ohms. Resistive plus J0. So let's examine the two points where the circle does cross the axis. One, we just drew the 1.7 plus J0. We'll call that point A. And then if we look around the other side of the circle, 180 degrees away, we'll see approximately around point 0.59 plus J0, we'll call that spot B. Anybody have any questions about any of this? Okay, now let's unnormalize it like we've done in the past, multiplying by 50. Well, if we multiply point A to 1.7 plus J0, we get 85 plus J0. If we multiply point B, which was the 0.59 plus J0, we get 29.5 plus J0. So now it's obvious that the 85 plus J0, that's not really, and let's concentrate more or less on approximately around 29.5 plus J0, which should take us somewhere, as they say, into the ballpark. However, he did say he has 100 feet of RG8U. Now, we have to find, number of wavelengths in the feed line. And to do that, formula called the feed line, or feed line formula for the number of wavelengths, and the formula is N for the number of wavelengths in the feed line equals capital L, which is the length in feet of the feed line. We're going to work in length in feet this time. That should make everybody happy. Times F, capital F, which is the frequency, which happens to be 14.000. And that's divided by 984, the constant 984, times K. Now, K is the constant of the cable, or the velocity factor. And if you look in the ARRL handbook, it'll tell you the line is terminal, type of line is, based on 100 feet, they give you the information on velocity factor or the propagation of the line. You'll see it in the chart. In this case, I looked it up. He gave it in make in the number of the cable, and it comes out to propagation of, 66.5. So now, if you do the math here, we get the wavelength of the feed line is equal to 0.95 wavelengths. Everybody get that so far, or I lose somebody somewhere along the line?
Okay, something is not quite right on that very last one, Mel. The wavelength of 14.1 megs that I calculated is around 69 feet. And because his velocity factor is 66% approximately, in the cable itself, a wavelength is going to be about 48 feet. So a 48 feet is the wavelength in the cable, and he's got 100 feet of it. He's going to end up with more than two wavelengths. I calculated roughly 2.15 wavelengths is what's inside of his 100 feet of cable. How about you, Mel?
All right, I don't know what I do wrong here. I got N equals the length in feet is 100 feet times the frequency in megahertz is 14.000 divided by 984 times 66.5. Do you have the same math, Dick? Over.
Yeah, but the 0.66 is a division. You multiply the 0.66 times the 984 before you do the division. So if you do it in separate steps, you're going to first divide by 984, and then you're going to divide by 66. So maybe that's it. When I used your formula, L times F divided by 984 times K, I ended up with 2.15 wavelengths. Go ahead.
All right. What did I do wrong then? Well, I multiplied 100 times 14.000, and then I took the multiplication of 984 times 66.9, Dick. And, I don't know, my calculator just came out to 0.95, over.
I just did it again, and I come up with 2.15. Okay, you admit that 14 megacycles times 100 is going to be 1,400. Divided by 984 is going to be 1 and a fraction. when you divide that by 66, it gets bigger. It turns out to be 2 in a fraction. So I keep coming out with 2 in a fraction. It's possible you multiply by 0.66 instead of dividing by 0.66 if you did that as a separate operation. Or, conversely, you multiply 984 times 0.66 before you do the division, which would have been 984 times 0.66 approximately. You would be divided by 649 instead of 984. So I think it's the multiplication versus the division that may be creating the difference. Mel, go ahead.
All right, well, I just did it. What the heck am I doing wrong? Okay, let's get this straight, because no use leading everybody wrong. First thing I did, let's see, I just multiplied 984 times 66.9. Let me do it again. Maybe I did it wrong. 984 times 66.9 equals, I got 65829.6. Do you have the same figure for that, 984 times 66.9, over?
Yes, 658.296. And you're going to be dividing that into 1400.
You've got to multiply by 0.66. Not 69 point something, Dick.
I'm confused.
We'll straighten it out. Hang in there, fellas. So the 658.296, that's the right number. And when you divide that into 1400, I think you're going to turn out to be 2.15 wavelengths. Take your time on that one, Mel.
Something I'm doing wrong. What am I pushing here wrong? Let me see. I have no idea. Maybe I was half asleep when I did it. 65829. Okay. And we got 1400. Okay. Minutes. Put it in again. 1400. 1400. Right? Divided by 65829 equals 213. Yeah, I don't know how I got this. 213, is that what you got, over?
You rounded off. I got 215, but close enough. So 2 in a fraction wavelengths of 14 megacycles is inside of 100 feet of RG8U polyethylene coax, which I think has got 66, you think 66.9% velocity factor, close enough, 2.15 approximately wavelengths. Mel, go ahead.
This is the WQVL repeater.
Okay, very good. So we got 213. I got 213. I don't know why is things rounding off to 213. Okay, well, anyway, where were we now? How the heck, I guess I got this all mixed up then, because I did a drawing here, and I came out to, before I did the calculation, I came out, I don't know where I got 0.95 wavelength. I must have goofed something here, so what I'll do is I'll have to recalculate and redraw this, Dick. Someplace I pushed the wrong button. I agree with you right now. I don't know how I did this wrong, but, something I did here. I goofed up something. I can't tell you right now. Let me redo this thing. Give me a couple minutes. Go ahead.
I just duplicated your mathematics. If I multiplied by 0.66 with the answer of 1400 divided by 984, I would end up with exactly what you said, 0.926. So if that last step of using the 0.669 velocity factor, if that ultimately was a division, you get the right answer. If you use that by mistake as a multiplication of the whole previous calculation, you'll end up with 0.9. So I think that was the mistake. Quite often people will do that. They don't realize that the K factor is multiplied by the 984, and both the K and the 984 are in the denominator of that equation. And that's an easy one. That's an easy fooler there, Mel. I've fallen into that trap a number of times.
Okay, one last thing.
Go ahead, Stefan.
Yeah, I was listening, I don't have a Smith chart, I was running my program, but fortunately on this computer I had an older version. I was just trying to see what how it came out in comparison. What was the input R and X for this thing at the start of 100 feet?
He just wanted to know the number of wavelengths in the cable. 14.0 megacycles, polyethylene RG8 cable, 100 feet of it. And when you plug that in, I think you're going to end up with something close to 2.15 wavelengths in that 100 feet of cable. Thank you, Fred.
Oh, yeah, I have 2.156. I didn't realize that I didn't have my current one. Did you ever look at my program? I think I emailed you about an earlier version that's been added on to considerably since.
Tell me the approximate date that you mailed that to me, Fred.
At my age, I have the foggiest idea of a couple of years ago. I do have a fairly recent one posted on the Stanford website, the ctsarah.org website. It's called, it's a feedlight analyzer program called SWRplot. And what it will do is it will, you can specify up to 10 bands or 10 band segments, and it will instantly calculate all of them at the same time. Admittedly, with a little bit of hand waving, but for most purposes, it will do it very quickly and fairly accurately.
Okay, so once again, that website for people who want to do this is charlietango7.org. And you look for the Fred Cunningham K1FC SWR plot. So that's question number one, did I get that right? And question number two, a couple of years ago, you and I used to talk 4.5 years ago while I was traveling to a particular customer at that time. So 4.5 years ago, I believe you mailed me a program, you're telling me. And at my age, I'm having a lot of trouble remembering what I had for breakfast yesterday. So no, I don't remember that. Do I have the website correct, Fred? Go ahead.
No, it's CTSARA, S-A-R-A, for the Stanford Amateur Radio Association.
Okay, CTSARA.org. Out of curiosity, what does the CT stand for? Oh, Connecticut. Connecticut, Stanford Amateur Radio Association.org. Okay. So some good programs there, and that's a good website to know it about. Thank you about that. Back to you, Rethno.
What threw me off here, I know I'm doing two figures here because I got the two things mixed up here. Because his wavelength and his cable, this was two different guys, and I got them balanced up, to tell you the truth, Dick. But the other one that I figured out and all, and I applied it because it was very similar, it was a very similar question. It was his wavelength came out to 0.95 wavelengths long, and I confused it with the feet. So that's what I did the mistake was with the wavelengths. It was 0.95 wavelengths in cable, not 100 feet thick over.
Understand. Okay. These are minor problems. Nobody died. And we'll straighten them out. And it's a learning process because this kind of a mistake, a velocity factor, divide when you should multiply. When it comes to calculating the number of wavelengths in the cable, you divide by 0.66. When it comes to calculating what is the length of the wave in the cable, you multiply by 0.66. So, it's easy to get that backwards. And if we don't go all the way to the end of that particular problem tonight, that's your choice, Mel. Thank you, Mel.
Okay. To DHU.
All right, DHU recognized. Go ahead, please.
Yes, just wanted to jump in there and say it's the first time I've heard this net. I got a retired event, but I've been listening for the last hour or so, and it's very, very interesting. Great bunch of guys, great bunch of information. Some of it's over my head, but it's really, really interesting. and I will listen again.
Sounds like we have another satisfied customer. Thank you, sir. We've been here for 24 years we've been doing this, every Sunday night on this exact repeater. So if all goes well and we still stay healthy, we'll be there next week, and welcome you to join us. That's you, Mel, K2KEY, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Okay, roger, roger. Yeah, that's where I made the goof, Noel. There was 0.95 wavelength cable that he had, not 95 to 100 feet or something like that. I based it on, 100 feet, the velocity factor, but it was wrong here. I reread it. 0.95 wavelengths wrong, 1.7 VSWR, and all. Okay, so that's what I came out with. All right, let's get back to. So if he said that the wavelength of the cable is 0.95 wavelengths, in order to put that back on a chart, we plotted the 1.7 SWR, which is correct. Now, if we take the cable of 0.95 wavelength long and factor that in, well, we can't put 0.95 on a chart because it only goes up to 0.5. So if we subtract 0.5 from 0.95 minus 5, we equal to 0.45 wavelength, and that should put us back on the chart. Now, if we look at the outer ring of the Smith chart, and we go down to 0.45 wavelength, we put a dot there. Now, if we take our straight edge and we draw a line between 0.45 wavelength and the center of the chart, put the straight edge between those two points, draw a straight line, and if we read the point now where the we just intersected our circle, we should read something like 0.64 minus, because we're below the reactance line, minus J0.21. And if we now multiply that by 50, we should get approximately 32 ohms resistive minus 10.5 ohms reactive. Basically, this is just doing very simple measurements of just using SWR. I think that's pretty much right, Dick. Over.
Sounds about right. I'm checking on that one right now. I'm doing this mathematically, not with a Smith chart. And the only one thing that we don't know is that we're making the assumption that his antenna, at the antenna itself, was purely resistive. We made that assumption because as he swept it in frequency, he got the lowest VSWR at 14.0. Therefore, we assume the reactance was zero at 14.0. It's a very good assumption. It's not perfect. I think it's accurate 95% of the time. If he's really got a thin wire dipole high in the air, the dipole in theory is 70 ohms, not 50 ohms, and he's using 50 ohm cable. So do you get the lowest VSWR? I think you do. I think I'm going to agree with that assumption, that there was no reactance left where the plot of standing wave ratio versus frequency hit the bottom dip. I'm going to agree with that. It's not always true, but in this case, I think it is. Go with it. K2KUY, K2IW, and the TechNet.
Yeah, I think that's in the ballpark, because the quarter wave vertical that he has, the 16 radial, that's a full-size vertical on 20 meters, so you could almost assume that it's got to be somewhere in the ballpark of about 36 plus J0, I would assume, Dick. Over.
That sounds right, and I'm now doing a further calculation, so I'll send it back to you while I finish this one now.
Okay, roger. All right, so he gets his best WF. It's a quarter wave vertical, 16 radials. His frequency is 14.00, and that's it. His RGA view, he says, they told him he had it a chart, and he says he looked it up, and that's 0.95 wavelength. I don't know how I got, I don't know where how I wound up with 95 feet or 100 feet of it or something. I most likely was, like I say, doing other things and did this quickly, and that's not the right way to go. So if it is 0.95 wavelength, and we subtract that, we get 0.45 wavelength to get it back on the chart. We bisect it, and if I read the resistance correctly, it's about 0.64 minus J0.21, which would yield us 32 minus 10.5 ohms. At least that comes out, I think, correctly, Dick. So I think with the way he measured it, it's a good ballpark figure, the 32 minus 10.5 ohms, over.
Sounds about right. I'm still in the middle of this calculation, and I made some goofs that I have to go back to the beginning. Back to you for the next minute, Mel, and then I'll be finished.
Okay, well, it's a good indication of, you know, with a very simple measuring system, because, you know, he's only using an SWR bridge. We have to take that as gospel that the SWR bridge is accurate to 1.7, and that the calculation of the cable and everything is approximately 0.95 wavelengths, and that's, so, you know, these two assumptions, with these two assumptions, I think he's most likely very close to that, so close that I don't think that it'll make any difference, any more precise measurements. But this is just an indication, even with a simple measurement and a Smith chart, that you can tell a heck of a lot about your antenna system. And if you want to carry it further, you can get down to the, draw lines down to your scale on the bottom of the Smith chart, and you can read your return loss in dBs, etc. So you can do a heck of a lot with just a simple SWR bridge if it's reasonably calibrated. Go ahead, Dick.
Go ahead,
Fred.
Yeah, my calculations was for an R of 30, X is 0, reading at the input, Z out 31.2, and X 10.6. So I used 44 feet, which is a 0.948 wavelength. Go ahead, Dick.
So you've had that program on that Connecticut SARA, S-A-R-A, which, by the way, also stands for Society of Amateur Radio Astronomers, Stanford Amateur Radio Association. So you've had that program on that website for, what, 3 or 4 years, possibly, Fred?
Yeah, it's been every once in a while I'll go through an iteration where I will improve it, add to it. And in fact, I'm not sure whether my last iteration got posted. I do remember I had some error in file handling, but the calculation part, if it's the latest version, there should be two calculations boxes, I think, was the last one. But you have to look at it. There's a plot, and what you do with it is you put your antenna, calculated. I originally designed it to go with MMANA, because they had some errors in their original thing, but I think they have updated that MMANA to... they may have gotten rid of some of the errors that I found, but that was one of the inspirations. Plus, I wanted to do it in units that everybody understood, so it's dBs per 100 feet, and it's a feet instead of meters and everything else. But when you put the data in, it will calculate everything instantaneously, and it comes with an example using a 102-foot dipole, and some window line, so that you can see what happens, various things. Terry, I think it was. I'm trying to remember. Terry, I think, was his last name. Yeah, he thought it was a pretty neat program at headquarters. Thank you, Dick.
I just went to the website of Stanford Amateur Radio Association, ctsara.org. I see this beautiful picture of a guy named Fred, K1FC. Looks like he's holding on to a two-element Yagi direction finder. I didn't realize, how recent is that picture? I didn't realize you were that young, Fred. Go ahead.
Thanks a lot. Oh, this was, well, it's not a Yagi. It's the kind of direction finder, the wavefront type.
So it's a two-element interferometer direction finder. How recent is that picture? Is that the way you look today?
Yeah, actually. That was taken last Thursday.
Fantastic. Okay. I didn't realize you were that young a fellow. Okay. And I haven't yet found your program on this because I got sucked up by the picture. So sounds like there's good stuff there. It's a good site that you guys keep current. You have reason to believe, Fred, that the one of the most progressive amateur radio associations in the is it Commonwealth of Connecticut? I think it's called Commonwealth, but I'm not sure. No, that's Massachusetts. We'll call it the state of Connecticut. Is one of the more progressive clubs, the Stanford Club?
Well, I wouldn't say we're one of the more progressive ones. A couple of clubs that are a little more progressive. Let's just say I represent the technical aspect of the club. Thank you.
Okay, good to know. And with a little bit more free time, I'm going to study this more, and I should have up till now. Back to you, Mel, if you want to proceed. Or are we going as far as you think we should tonight? We'll correct some of our math and come back with more accurate answers next week. It's your choice. K2KEY, K2IW in the TechNet.
Okay, yeah, I just reread the email. See, it came in two different parts, and I thought it was two different people, but I see where the confusion was. It was 100 feet, and it was that, and I recalculated it, you know, to 2.35 wavelengths. So then I see how he did it. He subtracted the most, largest number of integral half wavelengths to from this 2.35, and then I got approximately around 0.45. I see where it came from. It was a little bit of confusion here because he was mixing up a couple of times the different emails. He sent to me one with the footage and the other one with the calculated wavelengths in the feet and all, and then he said that he was proposed to use this cable and another one, and so I was trying to put it together, and I see now that I just lost it there, Dick, and it was, like I say, it was the original factor of 1.7 SWR, frequency is 14.000, quarter wave vertical, 16 radials. So if that is the what he intended for me to see with the 0.95 wavelength table, this is correct. So then it comes out. So with my drawing it on the Smith chart, I came out to 32 ohms minus 10.5, which I guess was confirmed by mathematics. That basically, I guess, just doing it with a compass and a straight edge, you can be fairly accurate. Over.
Yes, you can. And it's nice to see it charted as well as calculated, and you compare the two. Remember, a week or two ago, you and I were saying to people that if you're in the real engineering world and you're about to commit man hours and dollars to a particular project based on your calculations, a good backup system is to both use the physical Smith chart to get a graphic response if you've got somebody's respected program or your own fancy way of doing it with your handheld calculator. Do it theoretically also. Both answers better come out the same before you commit the man hours and dollars and end up with an egg on your face. And as you can see, with the math of wavelengths, it is extremely easy to do a multiplication when you should do a division or vice versa. But the overall bottom line of this man's antenna with approximately a 1.7 standing wave ratio or a little bit better is an extremely good antenna. He's only got two wavelengths of the cable, 100 feet. My guess is RG8 on 14 megacycles probably has a couple of tenths of a dB of loss per 100 feet. He's not losing much in the cable. Most transmitters with a 1.7 standing wave ratio will be fairly
Kathy. Most antenna tuners will tune that down to a 1-to-1 very easily. That system, I'm guessing, is 97% efficient. In other words, of all the power he's putting into that feed line, of the power that gets to the antenna, high 90% of it is being radiated into space, and the little bit of loss he's getting because of a little bit of Viswan is going to make a tenth of an S-unit difference on the other side, and with a QSB of one or two S-units, the person he's talking to will never know the difference. But it is nice to know exactly what's going on. What would happen if you put an impedance matching device? What would happen if you made the antenna a little bit shorter, a little bit longer? One of the studies I've been doing over the last week is to find out what are the best techniques that people have used for broadbanding the general dipole. And as you study further and further, if you particularly look at Chapter 9 of the last few issues of the ARL antenna book, Chapter 9 is on broadbanding techniques. And what you'll soon discover is that as you sweep above and below the design center frequency for a dipole, you get a whole lot of positive reactants when you go up in frequency and negative reactants when you go down. But the bottom line is the reactants moves very rapidly. The resistance is also changing, but very slowly. It also goes up, by the way. The resistive component of any dipole increases when you make the dipole physically longer, or let's call it electronically longer. But when the dipole is longer, as far as resonance is concerned, you're making it longer than the frequency you're feeding it, the resistive component goes up. When you make the dipole shorter, the resistive component goes down. The reactive component is doing the same thing, but much more rapidly. So of all the broadbanding techniques that people have come up with, and they usually consist of crisscrossing pieces of coax cable to act like the wire of the dipole itself, or to put filters in there with a resistor and things like this, an LC network. In reality, if you correct the reactive component and just ignore the resistive component, you've done 90% of the job. And what's really going on is that the one statement I have never read in any respected textbook, but it is extremely true, and every time I tell a new engineer that joins the company I'm working at this little secret, their eyes open up and they say, why hasn't someone told me that before? And that is, almost all of the antennas we use, with only two exceptions, all the antennas we use, when you want it to radiate well, you resonate it first, then it radiates. The reason that's true is that you've read and you didn't understand what it meant, but many articles will tell you that dipoles, Yagis, and similar antennas are standing wave structures. Only a rhombic or a beverage antenna is a traveling wave structure. Traveling wave structure means the wave flows down the wire once, goes to the termination at the far end, and dies, and never happens again. That's a traveling wave structure. 90-some-odd% of all the antennas we'll ever use are a standing wave structure. What really happens on that dipole is the signal goes down the wire, hits the egg insulator at the far end, which is an open circuit. It can't go any further. And because the open circuit is a high impedance, not a low impedance, it reflects without phase reversal. If there was a short circuit at the end, you would still have a reflection, but then there'd be a phase reversal. So it reverses in direction without reversing in phase. And then the signal flows back to the center where the center egg insulator is, where the transmission line is. But because each half of a dipole is a quarter wavelength long, it takes a quarter wavelength of time for the signal to go out to the end, another quarter wave to come back, total of a half wave. By then, the transmitter, half wave down in time, has transmitted the opposite polarity. If it was a positive wave that went down, the transmitter is now producing a negative wave, but a positive wave has come back. The two try to cancel. And so, the bottom line of all this is that the way a dipole works is that the signal bounces back and forth on that wire something like 30 times. And you could, in very simplistic mathematics, say that 1/30th of the power is radiated on each bounce. We all want to believe that radiation is very simple. You take a simple piece of wire and you make it into a dipole, or you take your 300 ohm twin lead and you split it down the middle until you get a half wave dipole or a folded dipole. In either case, making the antenna is so simple that we assume that the radiation process is simple. It is not. Radiation is hard. You have to either have many wavelengths of wire, like a rhombic or a beverage, to radiate, or you've got to allow the signal to bounce back and forth something like 30 times, and something like 1/30th of the power is radiated on each bounce. The bottom line of that is that if your antenna is a little bit short or a little bit long of the resonant length, all of those 30 bounces don't stay in step. They start falling out of step. If you made the wire a little bit too long, all of those bounces start falling later and later, and they fall out of step. Therefore, you don't get the positive and negative voltage coming back at the center trying to cancel each other and starting the next cycle. You start getting a phase shift of signal flowing back down the transmission line. We call that reactance. It looks like a capacitor if the antenna is too short, or it looks like an inductor if the antenna is too long. In reality, it was a phase shift because the bounces didn't all stay in step with each other. So once again, remember that truth that you will not read anywhere. You resonate first, then you radiate. And that's what we're really talking about here. So therefore, techniques for broadbanding a dipole are ways of making it go back in step when you're off center frequency. So you have to have another network that's almost as long physically as the real dipole in order to correct for that phase shift that occurs if you're off frequency. The fact that everything starts, all those bounces start falling out of step. And so I think there are more modern techniques with some fancy new circuits. I mean, there are operational amplifiers that will allow you to build something called a negative impedance converter or negative emittance converter, where you can, with an operational amplifier, electronically simulate or emulate a capacitor or an inductor. So there are all kinds of techniques for broadbending a dipole which you could do with an operational amplifier. I'd rather not do that. I don't want to put power into it. I'd rather use the techniques for broadbending that are done in a without applying power. In my particular application, I don't have a way of putting power into the network, so I want to do it without putting an extra power supply. So I'm doing a study on that subject right now, and as I said, Chapter 9 of the Antenna Handbook is very handy. If you simply do a Google search on dipole broadbanding techniques, you'll find a bunch of articles by Mr. Siebeck, W4ANL, I think his call letters are, and other people who have come up with quite a few techniques. I'll bet you there are 10 techniques out there for broadbanding a dipole. This particularly becomes important if you're an 80-meter operator. You build an ordinary wire dipole on 80 meters, and the band 80 meters is 500 kc wide from 3.5 to 4 megs. You tune that antenna for 3.8 megacycles, and from 3.7 to 3.9, it's usable. But you tune it at 3.7 or 3.8, and you want to use it at 3.5, you're going to have to live with a very high standing wave ratio, and your antenna tuner is going to have to work pretty hard. So lots of people have put lots of thought into broadbanding techniques for a dipole. Anybody got any further comments or questions on this subject, give Mel and me your call letters and name right now, K2RIW on the TechNet. Okay, looks like we're coming close to putting them to sleep, Mel. I'll go back to you for any further comments.
Okay, very good. This is KEY. Well, like I say, Dick, it's a good idea to take a visual and a mathematical calculation on, because you see what happens when you start confusing a couple of things here and all. I got, I start mixing up a lot of the emails here and all and trying to put together one thing, and, you know, they're not, some of the emails, I'm not going to say, are very confusing. I know I didn't answer a number of them, the questions to a number of them, because I don't even understand them. I actually just sent back question mark to them. And it's so hard to, you know, that's why I'm just trying to say I excuse me to those who are listening. If you sent me a problem that I can't seem to, you know, come up with an answer, because the only way I could say is I couldn't really discern really what you were trying to bring out or really what you were trying to ask me about the particular situation. It's very confusing. So I tell you the truth, Dick, some of them have been really starting to give me a bit of a tussle here as to trying to put it into words exactly what they're trying to convey, over.
I gave you warning. I told you when I first started publishing articles in QST and Ham Radio Magazine, and I started getting tons of letters. That was back in the days when snail mail was the only way to communicate. And nowadays with modern day computers, oh my goodness, I got hundreds of letters every year, some of which were impossible to answer. What they were asking was not clear, or in some cases, even if it was clear, they were asking very elaborate questions. And when they got the first one answered, they said to themselves, well, hey, I get some free consulting service here. I'm going to send more. And one particular man, in a six-week period of time, sent me 14 letters with a whole bunch of questions in each one. And eventually I had to stop saying, hey, fella, I can't live your life for you. And so what Mel and I are saying is that we do not make any promises that your emails will be answered. We can't promise that. We'll try. I'll read them, and occasionally I'll answer them. But you have to admit that each person who used to write me, and I guarantee each person who's sending you an email, he thinks he's the only person writing you. He doesn't realize there are quite a few others. He thinks he's the only one, and that he's the only person you have to concentrate on for the next week. On top of that, people who don't have a lot of experience at writing very frequently will write a letter which in their head is clear, but to somebody else reading it for the